Welcome to the London Walks podcast.
This episode, London Museums.
Okay, here we are, Adam. So I recognise this place.
I recognise this place too. This is the BM.
British Museum.
The British Museum.
It's the this is the most visited tourist attraction in London.
I'm not at all surprised. It's treasure trove barely covers it.
And I think it's the second most visited tourist attraction globally.
Globally.
Well, at least museum-wise.
Okay.
That one in Paris has got the number one spot globally.
Oh, okay, it's currently holding the number one spot. Ready to be toppled.
It's a beautiful building, isn't it? It's an amazing, amazing building. It's like I was saying a little bit earlier to you, actually. It's like a city within a city, isn't it? I mean, it's an incredible complex, isn't it?
Sure, I think that's a fair enough assessment of it. We're in the Great Court at the moment with the domed roof over the top, the glass triangles, letting in lots of natural light. Controversial for some. Some were unhappy with the new design. But here we are on a fairly chilly day.
Why were they unhappy with the design? What they didn't...
Was it His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales?
Oh, was it?
The Earl of Rothesay, the Duke of Cornwall.
Of course.
Our future king, who wasn't entirely happy with the design. Yeah. This is not his carbuncle, I don't think. His carbuncle was the National Gallery.
Oh, was it? Okay.
I'm sure he voiced an opinion on this. And indeed any other architectural phenomena after 1799.
So this is the reading room, isn't it?
We're right in the centre of the Great Court here, and the old British Library was housed in the middle of what is now the Great Court. And as you say, it's now moved to the Euston Road, a purpose-built structure there, now housing the British Library. So the British Museum in splendid isolation here now in Bloomsbury.
So 1753, 18th century, that was founding Sir Hans
Sloan, whose name can be seen all over London, of course, as well.
Gigantic collection.
Sloan Street, Sloan Square, named also for him. The founder of the British, well, the founder of the collection upon which the British Museum is based. And the museum develops as part of town in many ways, in so much as in the 1820s, the University of London was founded. If you've got such a resource on your doorstep, it would be a shame not to have a museum nearby, a university nearby to use it for study. And so the World's University, the University of London, is founded, I think, 1826, first university in the world to allow women to attend lectures, education for all.
Right. So originally, was it always open to the public, or was it just, you know, you had a specific membership and the
In fact, you can come and go. With our Karen on Saturday afternoon on the British Museum Walk. We can come and go today and browse the collection to our heart's content. My understanding of the original arrangement was that one had to write in and request a date. Yeah. And the suggestion seems to be that the curator or the curators would write back with a date at their convenience.
Right.
And you would be taken round the exhibits that they felt were good for you,
right.
And then you were shown the door.
Right.
So a much less user-friendly arrangement.
And that changed when the Natural History Museum was built, I think, because the idea was they didn't have room for a British history and a natural history, and they moved over to the Natural History Museum over to South Kensington, and the idea of that was going to be open for long hours, so all members of the public could come along and check objects out. So it was going to be... going to show off the wealth and diversity of creation. I think that was the idea of the Naturalist Museum, but we still have the British Museum here. So it's an incredible place, isn't it? So it opened free of charge for everybody.
Free of charge for everybody. And you mentioned South Kensington, the part of town that tourism mandarins in London are very keen for us to call Museum Land.
Yeah.
It's an absolutely dreadful name. Worse than Midtown, worse than NoHo.
Yeah. Albertopolis.
Oh, well, that's there we go. Yeah. If you want a nickname for South Kensington, it's had a nickname for a long time. Albertopolis, coined in Punch magazine.
Oh, right,
Punch
right.
magazine came up with Albertopolis. Right. Prince Albert helped with the great exhibition to raise investment and money, and the profits built South Kensington. I don't think Punch were being necessarily very, very kind to Albert when they called it Albertopolis. I think our satirical magazine of the day, I think what they were saying is, who does this German think he is telling us how to enjoy culture with his Albertopolis? But the name stuck for a generation or more.
Yeah, because they thought that was going to be a disaster. The Great Exhibition, they thought it was going to be a disaster. Of course it wasn't. Gigantic success.
Well, don't you think it seems that we did what we do. We did it for the Olympics. Right. We sat back, we folded our arms and said, no, not going to work. Yeah. We don't like this. A popular success.
Yeah.
The Great Exhibition particularly, I think, there are tales of people coming from all over the country to enjoy the Great Exhibition, which sounds a bit ho-hum today, but in 1851, to travel across the country, you know, is a very difficult thing.
And an incredible piece of architecture. Gigantic glass buildings. He had all the green lobby. He didn't want to take over the South Park of Hyde Park, the lungs of London.
So he built
a huge glass building over the top of all the trees.
Yes, which then moved in 1854 to the part of South London that nobody really calls Upper Sydenham anymore. Crystal Palace, of course.
And was that Punch magazine as well? Crystal Palace?
Was that a satirical nickname of the day as well?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
that maybe would make sense. Idea of people coming from all over the country, though, is an astonishing one. There are tales of, I don't know, say a village in the Wild West of Wales, they would pass the hat round and send someone to the Great Exhibition on behalf of the village, a teacher preferably someone who could draw and write, and they would race round the Great Exhibition, make notes, take sketches, and then come back and do a couple of nights at the church hall, describing what they'd seen, you know, before the multimedia age. So a thrilling and popular spectacle for the people of Britain.
The first kind of world trade fair. Is that how you describe representatives from all over the world with different exhibits?
Quite so, particularly from the United States. I think that's not a bad description. And of course, it begat the world's first theme park as well when they moved to Upper Sydenham. The dinosaurs there in the grounds of the Crystal Palace.
Which are hilarious, aren't they?
They are an absolute glory, the dinosaurs, which have been refurbished more than 10 years ago now and reopened by His Royal Highness Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh. I wonder, is there a joke in there about dinosaurs? I wonder. If only we could work it out.
So that's the museum quarter. Then what do we call Bloomsbury then? The Museum Mile, did you say?
Mile is a term that's bandied around because we have, it's this colossal place really upstages everything in its wake. And along this so-called Museum Mile, we've got lots of little gems. We've got the Grant Museum of Zoology and Comparative Anatomy. Grant was the lecturer at Edinburgh University who taught Charles Darwin. Wow. So Darwin is the show business end of evolution.
Grant's the man.
Grant de man. Who de man? Grant de man. A wonderful teaching museum, only open in the afternoons, and it's very near the Petrie Museum of Egyptology, also a teaching museum. William Flinders Petrie was an Egyptologist who was interested in the smaller details. So he would, rather than collecting enormous monuments and statuary, he would pick up smaller pieces of smaller artifacts, which led to a greater understanding of the everyday practices of ancient Egypt. So a glorious little museum. We've got the Cartoon Museum nearby. I'm going to say a few words about that a little later on in the podcast because it's one of my favourites.
Yeah, I was going to talk about the old operating theatre, which is over by a museum, which is opposite Guy's Hospital, which is
now,
great.
I hear that's a vivid place.
It's fantastic. When you kind of think of operating theatre, I mean, that never really struck me before, but when you enter there, it's all seating, tiered seating in the round. And right in the centre is the only perfectly preserved, I think, 18th century operating table in the country. It's much smaller, because people tend to be smaller. It's got hack marks all over it. Oh. I did a walk the other day, and there was a fellow, a surgeon from the Royal College of Surgeons, and he was saying the tiered seating have very high backs to stop the students from falling over into the operating kind of area, because students would watch these dissections and anatomizations taking place there. It's an incredible place. It's
own entertainment in them days before we had the television.
Yeah, it's an amazing. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And also I thought Sir John Soane is in, which is just absolute stuff full of these kind of incredible curiosities, really. That's very interesting. And all very, very close to John Soane Museum is just around the corner from here, isn't it?
Yes. I'm heading off now from the British Museum over the road to the small but perfectly formed Cartoon Museum, and you'll be hearing from me in the next episode of the London Walks podcast. In the meantime, Andy is hot-footing it across town to the old operating theatre by London Bridge.
Okay, I'm here with Kevin Flood, who's the creative director of the operating theatre. We're in Southwark. We're just under the shadow of the Shard. Why is the operating theatre in the... Why are we in the top part of a church?
Well, it goes back to the origins of St Thomas' Hospital, which was just here by London Bridge. It's now over by Westminster, but it used to be here just to the east of London Bridge on the south side. The hospital was built here, and they had a church that went with the hospital, and they had the surgical ward was built right up against the church.
Right.
And when they needed to have more operating theatres for demonstrating surgery in the 19th century, they just thought, let's bung one in the roof of the church. It was rebuilt in 1703 right. by Thomas Cartwright. And in 1822, they ordered that an operating theatre be built in the Herb Garret.
Right.
And then in 1862, the hospital moved from this site and it eventually ended up where it now is in Lambeth near Westminster.
Right,
so they closed it down in 1862.
And St Thomas's went right back to the 12th century, they reckon?
It was ancient in 1215. Right. It was named after Thomas Becket.
Right.
Who was made a saint in 1172 or 73.
And this was part of the women's ward.
Yeah, well, when they rebuilt the hospital, they built the surgical block right up against the side of the church, and on the floor, almost level with the roof, was the women's surgical ward. Previously, they had a male operating theatre, where they did demonstrations to train students in surgical practice. But I think what happened was that the training of surgeons had become such big business that they needed to do more demonstrations. And the only way they could do that is by operating in public on the other 50% of the population, which are the female ones. And previously they only operated in private in a room on the ward itself.
Right.
So in 1822 they decided to build a new operating theatre. And it so happened that the roof of St Thomas' Hospital was right next to the women's surgical ward. So they just knocked a door in and built the operating theatre in the roof of the church.
So this is one of the oldest operating theatres in Europe.
This is 1822. There are dissection theatres in other parts of Europe, which are older. But this is, as far as we know, the oldest operating theatre that still sort of survives in some form or other.
Wow. So antiseptic surgery was the 1840s or so?
1860s.
Okay, so this is prior to that?
Yes, prior to that and prior to anaesthesia.
Okay.
Anaesthesia was in the 1840s, and antiseptic surgery was in the 1860s, so this predates both of those. It was used before either antiseptic surgery or anaesthesia.
So if you were going to do an operation before that, what were you, there were ways of knocking people out, I suppose it was opiates or how?
No, they just didn't. They didn't knock people out. I mean, there's always this kind of a bit of a myth that people might be knocked out or people might get dead drunk.
Right.
Well, I'm not saying these things didn't happen, but as you know, if you knock someone out, you risk killing them. So
yeah,
they wouldn't have done that.
Okay.
And they wouldn't have got someone drunk for similar reasons, but also because there's a terrible feature of pain. It tends to sober you up quite quickly. So you've got a drunken idiot on, you need someone's cooperation with if you're doing the operation, because it's actually rather painful. And if they're going to be fighting you, which a drunk person's going to do, it's going to make things worse. So they would certainly have given you a swig of brandy to strengthen your resolve, but they wouldn't have got you drunk.
And I suppose if you were going to do an amputation, for example, speed would have been the essence.
Speed was the essence, yeah. That's what made a good surgeon.
It was
because there was no anaesthesia, so you just did it as quickly as possible. So they became, that was almost their, like beating their chest was to say, I did it in 30 seconds, or you did it in 31 seconds. You know? So it became the thing that made a proper surgeon that you could do it quickly.
So it was almost like a performance in a way, though. I mean, one thing that strikes me is when you walk into the theatre, I mean,
seating in the round. It's sort of a bit like a Greek amphitheatre or Shakespeare's Globe, but it's on a smaller scale and inside. That was just to maximise the number of people who could see. I don't think they were consciously copying those examples, but it was to get as many people around. And it was very highly raked, too, so that as many people could see as vertically into the operation as could be. So you want to be as high above it as you can to see what was actually going on.
Would there be cries of heads?
Yes, there was. Apparently it was a kind of a
noisy...
Not
because they were lopping the heads off.
No. It was a very noisy atmosphere because you had something like 100, 150 young men who come in to watch the operation. So they probably would have been a bit... Well, there are descriptions which make it sound like it was quite unruly. But I think it depended upon the surgeon. I think some surgeons would have demanded absolute hush, right, and others would have been sort of, you know, quite happy with a bit of a hubbub.
And these were apprentices coming into.
Yeah, they're all apprentices, because up until the 19th century, really, surgeons were not trained at university, nor were apothecaries for that matter. So doctors were trained at university, hence they were called a doctor because they got a doctorate. But surgeons, because they were trained by apprenticeship, were called Mister. And to this day, surgeons call themselves Mister.
Right, okay. Is that also to do because people don't have such a high opinion of surgeons before anaesthetists?
Well, people say that, but I suppose there is hierarchy that a physician is at the top of their trade, and most of us would never see a physician. Only rich people see physicians.
Right.
Most of us would have gone to an apothecary or to a surgeon apothecary. And they were a bit lower down the social scale. But on the other hand, a really good surgeon could, you know, afford a really, really good salary. Because if you actually think about it, there was like one surgeon, like Cheselden, he managed to reduce an operation sort of down from about 40 minutes down to 10 minutes.
Right.
And if you're in pain for 40 minutes, how much are you going to pay him?
Yeah,
so that
yeah,
you can yeah, reduce 30 minutes
yeah,
of pain.
Okay.
So he was, they were very, very well paid.
So these people could potentially die of trauma and also infection, which they knew nothing about.
Well, obviously they knew about it, but they had no idea what the cause was. And they even had this idea of something called laudable pus. And laudable pus, I mean, there's no pus that is laudable.
Right,
but it wasn't gangrenous pus, in
right,
other words.
Okay,
so
okay,
laudable pus was just normal infection.
Right.
And they thought that was good.
Okay.
When in fact we know it's a symptom of infection. So they didn't. They'd probably all been brought up with the idea that cleanliness is next to godliness. Well, in those days, they'd have probably just washed their hands in the morning, had a look at them, think they're clean enough, and carried on with it. Yeah.
But I also read that there was, you know, they would wear these coats which were kind of stiffened with blood.
Yeah,
and it was, you know, a good surgeon was a busy surgeon.
Yeah.
The more blood on you, the more.
Yeah. John Flint South wrote a memoir, and he worked in this operating theatre, almost certainly in this operating theatre, but he worked for St Thomas's Hospital. And he wrote this memoir, which is very, very interesting. But, I mean, part of it is people looking back. So
yeah,
they're going to tell you a good story, a good anecdote, so they're going to make it as gory as possible. Yeah, but
yeah,
what he does, what they do say, is that the surgeon would either wear an apron, a butcher's apron that they kept here, or a frock coat which they kept here. And these
right,
were described as being stiff with blood and pus.
Right.
And there is that sort of idea that the more blood you were, the more it looked like you were doing working
right,
a lot. But
right,
again, I suspect that's slightly exaggerated. But it's clear that they used to wear frock. There's even images of surgeons wearing top hats.
Right.
So
okay,
there was formal in that.
Yeah.
And Percival Potts from St Thomas's, when he did demonstrations of anatomy, he wore his ceremonial sword. So, you know, it was a formal occasion. You've got 100 people around you, so you have to dress for the part.
Right, okay. There's that anecdote, isn't there, about, was it Robert Liston, who first 300% mortality rate in the operation
yeah,
he did, and it took him 28 seconds to chop off the leg, but also the right testicle of the attendant holding the patient down.
You see, there you go. I used to tell that story for about the first 10 years of my 25 years in this operating theatre, and I used to say it was the left testicle.
Right, okay,
And I know I read that somewhere, but we've looked. That's much repeated in very, very august books by academics.
Right.
And we've looked for a source for it, and we haven't been able to find it. So certainly the 300% death from one person, you know, the patient died. And
the testicle went and
someone
fainted
right,
and died of
concussion. Yeah, that's right. So whatever that was, we've not been able to find any evidence of it, but
right,
I'm sure accidents happen.
Okay. So we're also, this is part of a herb garret here as well. Just tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, we haven't got the faintest idea. Well, your idea of what a herb garret is as good as mine, but all we know is that this place was called the herb garret.
Right.
In 1822, an operating theatre to be built in the Herb Garret, and that's
right,
really all we know about it.
Right.
Well, there are a couple of other things, but what we know is that it's next door, virtually next door to the apothecary, who lived
right,
two or three doors up the road. And secondly, they found when they rediscovered the operating theatre in the 1950s, they discovered some opium heads in the rafters.
Right.
In the rafters, there are some planking, which suggests that they'd got racking up there for storing
right,
things. And so putting that all together. I mean, there were ropes when I first came in hanging from the ceiling. And I always thought that was, you know, for unsuccessful curators to hang themselves. But I think they were for, for holding up herbs. And what we think was it was used for storing and curing herbs. Right, okay. And they, if you think about it, if you've got buildings, you use them for wards, offices, storehouses, whatever. And the stuff you need to store, you store in the cellar,
right,
or the loft or the garret. The cellar's damp.
Yeah.
So it's not good for herbs.
Right.
And the attic or the garret is very good for herbs because it's quite dry.
So atmospherically it's quite good for storing.
This is really like a barn on top of a church. Very, very unusual in itself.
Yeah.
Barn on top of a church. And because it's got huge oak timbers, they act as buffers. So when it's damp, the wood soaks in the dampness. When it's dry, they give out it's got a nice sort of even, and that tends to dry things rather than to rot them. You can imagine if you've got a damp condition, then all the herbs that are hanging down are just going to go rotten, which is not what you want. You want to dry.
And I noticed when I walked in there, the operating table, what period is the table from then? Is that from the...
It's from the 19th century, and it was, you mentioned Liston. Now, Liston was the famous surgeon at the UCL Hospital, which was the first, he was the first person to use anaesthesia in this country. And that table was from UCL. Wow. And what happened was, when this operating theatre was rediscovered in 1957, and they restored it in 1962 and opened it as a museum in 1962, the people at University College had this table, which was used in the carpentry department for chopping wood. Right. And when they looked at it, it was fairly obvious it was an operating table because it's got a flap which you pull out if someone's long. You can extend it to make it longer. And it's got a little wooden pillow. So it was definitely an operating table. And that is 19th century, came from UCL and was donated to the museum.
So the hack marks, they're from carpentry rather than butchery.
Well, there's two things. There's some red stains on it, and there's lots of saw cuts. And many school children who come here like to think that the red is blood and that the saw cuts are surgeons' mistakes. And they're probably carpenters' mistakes.
Right.
You know, some might be, you know. Yeah. So,
and I did notice, I mean, the first thing I noticed was it's very small.
It's small, but again...
You can extend it.
You can extend it. So it's actually, if you think about it, quite a lot of operations are going to be on your arm when you want to be sitting up rather than lying down. Okay. And if it's on your leg, it's long enough for any... It's long enough for you without extending it for your knee.
Right.
But if it's for the lower leg, you just extend it out a little bit. So it's perfectly long enough for it. I've never seen anybody on it who's too big for it.
So it wasn't because of diet, people were smaller, and that's why they were smaller. I mean, that was
statistic
was the case as well.
Suggests that people had the same sort of range as us, but on average, they were probably about 2 inches smaller. But you might still have someone 7'6" and someone 4'11". But on average, because of better nutrition, now people are on average a little bit taller, but not as much as people think. And small doors, people always say that's because people are small. It's not.
Yeah.
It's just because doors let drafts in.
Oh, right.
And you didn't want to pay a lot of money for wood, so you had small doors. So it wasn't because people were smaller.
And you have a whole kind of collection of what looked like, I suppose it wouldn't be that different today, really, but what looked like a very sinister collection of, you know, tools for doing these operations. I mean, the last time I saw stuff like that was at my dental hygienist, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But was it?
That,
I mean, they
quite interesting. They are very, in some ways, they're very similar to what we have now, and somehow they're very different. But they're similar in the sense, like the saw is not that different to the saws they have now. The difference is that the original saws had organic materials in them, and would have been a place where infection could have easily spread.
Right.
The modern ones are now disposable.
Right.
And of course, I think if you came here in 100 years' time, they would be horrified to think that people were still using saws, because I'm sure in the future they'll use some form of you won't have to operate by opening somebody up. You'll be able to operate by some sort of, I don't know, ultrasound or something like that, I'm sure. So people will think in 100 years' time that what we've got is primitive. While, as I said, many of the equipment is very similar, but it's just that some are now they're disposable and hygienic, and previously they were not disposable and they were not hygienic.
Well, I suppose operations originally wouldn't have been that invasive, so you wouldn't have gone, this. We're talking kind of...
Yes, you wouldn't, anything, if you penetrated the body, generally, you killed them because of infection. So you couldn't get into any of the body cavities, you couldn't get into their skull, deeply into the skull, obviously. You couldn't get into the chest cavity and you couldn't get into the stomach. If you went into the stomach, then people would almost... That's why people died of bullet wounds in the stomach, because of infection. And the only things they did were things like wounds, sores, things that were on the surface, like fistulas and hernias.
Yeah.
And they did bladder stone removals, but I won't tell you how they got into the body that way, but they managed to get into the body and go without going through the perineum, which would have killed the patient.
So, I mean, this is, I immediately think of Samuel Pepys, and that kind of, when he describes having, is it a kidney stone removal?
Bladder stone removal. Horrible, wrapped up. Yeah. Well, he celebrated that operation every year as if it was his birthday. And well, he might, because it was incredibly painful. What he didn't know, which I'm sure he would like to have known, and the fact he didn't have any children was probably due to that operation.
Right, okay.
It probably sterilised him as well. And I'm sure you know what Pepys was like. He would love to have known. He went to a lot of effort to try and stop his various women getting pregnant, but he didn't need to worry about it because he probably was sterile.
Of course, it's worth it, though, because he wrote it all in a shorthand, so she couldn't get...
That's right, yeah. But the other interesting thing about that operation was, which needs to be remembered, that charitable hospitals like St. Thomas's, people only came to these hospitals if they were poor. If you were rich, like Pepys was, or wealthy, like Pepys was, the surgeon came to your house. And a St. Thomas's surgeon went to Pepys's. We went to his, I think it was his cousin's or one of his relatives' house, and they did the operation on the kitchen table at the cousin's house.
Well, this is a fantastic place. So you're open
7 days a week, 10:30 to 5. We do lectures in the afternoons on Saturdays and Sundays, and we also have evening lectures.
I mean, the website is brilliant as well. There's a fantastic virtual tour. You can go around the whole building.
It is.
But it's really worth visiting. I mean, I think it's absolutely fascinating. And what I loved about it is the history. Would it be monks, first of all?
This was originally an Augustinian monastery, and it was run by 3 monks and 3 nuns. Quite interesting. If you go to the cathedral, there's the tomb of John Gower, the poet.
Yeah.
And in his will, he left money for the monks and the nuns of St. Thomas's Hospital in the medieval period. And what's interesting was that he left twice as much money to the men than he did to the women. So unequal pay goes all the way back to that particular period in time.
And so the idea of actually cutting into someone would have been sacrilegious or something. Is that the idea? And the barbers came along after that, and then the surgeons, and then they amalgamated the company.
It's difficult to know exactly what happened, but I think it was the 12th century, the Pope forbade clergymen from operating on people. Okay. And the reason for that was because I'm guessing the reason for that was because most doctors were educated, so therefore that meant they were probably trained by the church, which meant that they were some form of clergyman. And that's fine if a clergyman is looking after you and you die of a disease, because that's God's will. But if the cleric is operating on a table and you die, it's kind of like the cleric has killed you.
Right.
It's more of a direct thing. So the surgeon didn't want the church to get into bad reputation. So he said that it's all right for doctors to continue to be physicians and be general medical practitioners, but it's not right to them to practice surgery because that's killing the patient. And so surgeons became separated from physicians, and surgeons became secular. Well, doctors remained university trained.
Really recommend people coming. I think it's absolutely wonderful. But you do a number of other walks as well. You are your guide for London Walks as well.
No, I do occasionally.
Many other jobs as well.
Yeah, I do. I've got lots of... I also lecture at university, but I've always loved doing guided walks since I was an archaeologist in the Museum of London. Yeah. And London Walks is a great organisation. So they're kind enough to let me indulge me by doing my favourite archaeological walks, once a month. I tend to do the first Saturday of most months, and if it's got the word archaeology in it, it's a good chance it might be me. Decline and fall of Roman Empire and that sort of
thing. Well, I've heard a lot about them, because when I've done walks, people said, I went on this the archaeology walk the other day and really enjoyed it and loved it. So brilliant.
Good to get the feedback.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
London Walks podcast was compiled, produced, and presented by Andy Hallett and Adam Scott Goulding. For details of the full programme of London Walks, London's best guided walking tours, go to www.walks.com. The London Walks podcast was an APB production.